Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-hosts and friends, Jenny McGrath and Shelby Hoffer, former members of YWAM. Shelby, Jenny, it's good to be back and to talk about youth with a mission and talk about some of the internal makeup and structure of the organization. I have, as you both know, have been digging into it as it relates to the broader charismatic movement, trying to understand how you can move forward in such a way that you're attracting children to go on these missions, if you call them that, into these Youth with a Mission camps. And I'm just to let you in on a little secret, I'm kind of driven because of a statement that my grandfather made in his resignation speech at the Branham Tabernacle. He said that, I know what they're doing. They're trying to get at the children, because if they can get to the children, they can get to the parents. And if they can get to the parents, they can get to their pocketbooks. And that's pure, plain, and simple why I'm trying to dig into this. I want to understand what this is and why this is. So I'm glad that you both came back and want to talk about more of the structure of YWAM.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that comment, because I was reading through some of the book by Lauren Cunningham called Making Jesus Lord, The Dynamic Power of Laying Down Your Rights. And he was talking about a conversation he had with Keith Green, who was a musician, and he tragically died in a plane crash, but they were having a conversation. They were praying. And he said, Keith was lying face down on the carpet, crying out for lost souls. We asked God for 100,000 young people to go out as missionaries from America, especially those who were 18 and 19 years of age. And it goes on and on. But I was like, specific. That's very interesting. So yes, it's definitely part of the youth with a mission.
Yeah, it's as you say that, a story comes to mind, and we'll get more into the YWAM foundational values, one of which is hearing the voice of God and how complicated that can be. And I was thinking about when I was in YWAM, I was doing a school, I was in Montana, and I was certain that I had heard from God. I needed to trust God for my money for outreach, and I did not have it. I was woefully short. And my parents were like, well, just let us help you. And I was like, no, I am supposed to rely on God. And so then I didn't think I was going to go on outreach because I was like $1,000 short. And then my leader came and told me someone made an anonymous donation to our school for $1,000. And for years, I told this story of like, God made this giant breakthrough. And one day a friend just asked me, so your dad just didn't call and make an anonymous donation because he wanted you to go on outreach? And I was like, oh my gosh, I never even thought that that was a possibility. And I asked my dad and he's like, I honestly don't remember. Maybe, maybe not. And I'm like, that is probably the most likely scenario, that my parents had already invested thousands of dollars into my training and into my program. They wanted me to see it through. And so that trajectory of going to the children, to the parents, to the pocketbook brought up that very, very practical example of how that plays out.
Well, you know me, my brain works in mysterious ways. But whenever I see that there is a large sum of money flowing through something and there are people submitting themselves or forfeiting their rights, I usually go pretty hard towards it to try to figure out what it is and why they're doing it. And part of that ambition, as I said, is my grandfather. But the other part is I grew up forfeiting my rights. We had, and you don't either one know this, we had a doctrine in Branhamism that actually made its way into the broader movement, the Latter Rain movement, that a Christian forfeits his rights. And when I heard the title of that book, Making Jesus Lord, Laying Down Your Rights, that came directly from this movement. It's the idea that if you join our movement, you're going to be our kind of Christian and you're going to submit to us. That's essentially what it's saying. And it's anti-biblical. If you read the book of Acts, you find Paul, he's claiming his Roman citizenship in certain cases where he's claiming that I have this right. And he's doing the opposite of what they're saying, but they want you to believe that if you become a Christian, you will forfeit your rights and submit to them. And I honestly, I did not know that YWAM had a book like this, but I have seen this in other very destructive movements where the followers, they just submit their full being to the leaders and the leaders just wreak havoc in their lives.
Yeah, that's certainly a key component of the structure of YWAM. And I, again, as I was sort of just perusing through some of my notes from the book, you know, they're talking about laying down your rights, and Jesus was showing us how to live our lives. He was showing us how to win over the devil. He was giving us the strategy for accomplishing the greatest job ever given to man, taking over the earth from Satan and winning it back for God. Jesus was showing us that the only way to conquer is to submit. And there's so much in this book that, you know, goes so much along with that. It's really interesting, John, to have that connection made, because that's almost word for word what you just said is written in this book. So it's certainly part of the foundation of the organization. And it's something that we wanted to begin to talk about, looking at some of the foundational values. There was some things that, you know, in the previous episodes that I had done with you guys, some things that people had, you know, sort of, why are you guys talking about this? And, you know, who are you? And you don't even know, because, you know, I had a good experience over here and that sort of thing. And so I just had wanted to reiterate some of the spaces that I've walked in over my 18 years in YWAM. I was personally at bases in Colorado Springs, in Kona, Hawaii, Perth, Australia, Phnom Penh, Cambodia, Manila, and Bacolod, the Philippines, Brittany, Chatel, and Villers, Switzerland, Port-au-Prince, Haiti, after the big earthquake. I've worked with clients who have experienced abuse from North America, South America, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Asia, the Middle East, Northern Africa, and South Africa itself. I've also personally been told these stories or researched probably close to 1,000, if not more, personal stories. I have also worked at leadership at my local level in member care for YWAM Europe. I was in the leadership team of that as well. And I was part of the global leadership gathering in 2023, which is sort of like a invitation only. The world's top 700 leaders are invited to come to this, you know, massive gathering, where we received a deathbed message by Lauren Cunningham saying that YWAM is a calling, and if you leave YWAM, you lose your calling. I sort of had wanted to lay that out in the space of saying, I really deeply understand the pushback that we get when we talk about YWAM. People had, you know, maybe really deeply felt like they encountered God in their experiences, or they're still in it. I have people that I love very deeply who are still part of the organization. And so we're not here to try to burn it all down or anything like that. But we do want to talk about the ways that the system attracts and often traps people. And like John, you said, really young people a lot of the time. I think you've had a guest named Daniel. He's talked about this. He's in Norway and he sees sort of, he's YWAM adjacent, sees people sort of sucked into it. Jed Hartley, I think, has talked about this sort of in connection YWAM, IHOPKC, Bethel, all sorts of that. So that's just something that I wanted to identify and lay out there as we begin to sort of examine these foundational values and the core beliefs and things like that, to try to help to bring understanding for people who are outside of it. And hopefully shine some light for maybe people who have been inside of it or who are still inside of it, to be able to help them maybe turn on that critical thinking a little bit more, to begin to engage some of that. And we are very open for good faith questions and, you know, people who are genuinely curious. And I think me and Jenny had a conversation prior where we were saying, you know what, if We would love to hear about places where there's been abuse or something horrific has happened and it has been dealt with really well. And the victims were cared for and it was reported to the proper authorities and YWAM took responsibility and removed those leaders or whatever. So I think we wanted to sort of put that out as well, that if anybody has stories like that, please, please let us know in the comments. Contact John. Let us know if that's something that you have, because we would love to know about that.
Thanks so much, Shelby. I appreciate just the context. And I think I've shared this in bits, but I love you laying out your experience. And so just feels important to share. I was sort of grafted into YWAM when I was still in high school. I went to a missions event that my church was having, and I was very sure I wasn't going to go on this mission trip to China with YWAM, but the Colorado Springs base was very, very persuasive and got me to go the summer after I graduated high school. And as I was preparing to go, they convinced me to partake in community nights, and then they convinced me that a DTS would be a great idea. And so I sort of got really, really funneled in, and I was part of Colorado Springs. I was essentially starting a base in northern Uganda. I was sending Ugandans down to southern Uganda to do discipleship training schools so that we could eventually build a base in northern Uganda. I worked in Sudan, South Africa, Montana, Thailand, Malaysia. I also spent many years in many different places. And just last night, I found an old hard drive of mine that I was going through, and it was most of my pictures from YWAM. And I've honestly been feeling so emotional because there were such incredible experiences. There are and were such beautiful people. And one of the things that I'm hoping we can disrupt is this binary. And I think that that's part of what sucks people into cultish or high control religions, is that everything is either or. And so we're not actually here to dismiss the beauty and the fun and the relationships and the community that come. And we're talking about how those things also get infused with a culture that asks so much of us, and that as John and Shelby have already said, it demands you to lay down your rights and your agency as a human being. And so that's the complexity that I think we're going to be wading into. And I'm excited to do that. I think this is an important conversation.
And I want to bring another aspect of binary. So if you're in a healthy Christian church and you have a youth program, usually it's done like this. The youth work with the ministers or the leaders of the program. But there's another aspect to it where the leaders are also working with the parents, because they're training both sides so that both can come together and both can be more, have a more fulfilling Christian life together. In other words, it's bringing families together, not separating them. But when I hear things like the massive amount of money that it takes to get into a YWAM base, and then in the title of the book, I'm in shock that you said this, because I'm going back through every memory that I have of submission and the doctrines that come with it. When I hear those two things, it's problematic for me. It really is. I have, in fact, just weekend before last, I was working with a group from another church, and they had a program where I believe it was the parents that was working directly with the teens and early 20s to show them about the Bible, connect with them, help them grow as a family unit. How can you grow as a family unit if you're taking the children away from the parents? So the next question that I'm going to ask, and I just don't know, was there a component in Youth with a Mission where they actually work with the parents to join back to the children and bring families together instead of splitting them apart?
That's a hard no. Let me actually even quote from this book again. This is probably going to be helpful during this conversation. So he's beginning to talk about what it means to lay down your rights and to submit your whole will and all of that stuff. And he says, for family relationships, as with everything else in life, God's principle always works. We only win when we give up. As we grasp something, we lose it. When we surrender it to God, we gain it. If we hold our loved ones in a tight grip, we end up losing them. Only God deserves to be first. It doesn't work any other way. If we surrender our family to God, we gain them. So there's certainly, and I know that not everybody has experienced this, so it's very explicitly said, you know, hey, we encourage you for the time that you're here, especially if you're in a DTS. Maybe don't connect with people back home so much. Some people have had time limits put on them. You can connect only like 1 hour a week with friends and family back home. We, you know, you're here, you're setting this time apart for God. You know, it's only 6 months. Like, they don't understand. You know, we don't want people to pull you away from this time set apart. There's really this language that is this time set apart, this time set apart for God. You've chosen, you've invested. And then it begins to be like, well, people won't understand. And when you come back from your outreach phase, so when you have traveled then to do hopefully some sort of missions work after your 3 months lecture phase, then you have a 2 to 3 months outreach phase. That's the language. Oftentimes in the debrief, sort of the last week of the course, they will give tips and pointers on how to like share your testimony with people back home. And there is very often this sort of phrasing that is told to these people that people won't understand what you've been through. They won't understand YWAM. So here's how you can sort of change the YWAM language into language that might be understood. And you're sort of prepared to go back and feel separate because you've had this amazing experience. You've had this encounter with God, and you'll not find it in your home church. You'll not find it back in your humdrum, you know, sort of. They have a thing they say called ruined for the ordinary. You've been ruined for the ordinary. So you can no longer go back to the ordinary. And you're probably going to feel that. That's what's been, you know, told. Like, if you're feeling like, oh no, something's missing, then it's because God has ruined you for the ordinary. And you have to just come back to YWAM because we're the only ones that understand. So this is something I've heard just all the time. Myriad, this is a very common experience.
For me, I had an experience of, in many different ways, scripture was taken out of context and used. And so even as we say this, and we're talking about this, what comes to mind is that Matthew 19:29 was always quoted, which was, and anyone who has left his house or brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers or wife or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. And it was sort of meant to be like, this is speaking directly to you, and you should leave your fathers, your brothers, your sisters, because God is going to give you so much more in eternity. And everything in this life was considered a means to an end. And, you know, I would often say when I was in YWAM, my body's a machine. And I really treated my body and my relationships that way, that everything was just meant to be a functional thing for the end of days or for eternity. All the while, the way that YWAM also functions is building a lot, as we've talked about, of capital wealth in countries and sustaining livelihood for leaders that is very cush. But that's not how I lived and how I think most of the people, especially the younger people in the organization, live.
And yet another connection that I was unaware of. That was the language that was used in the Latter Rain movement in the phase whenever it was starting to suck people out of churches. Whenever you talk the leaving rhetoric, you're trying to get people to leave something they're comfortable with and join you, join your mission, if you call it that. In the Latter Rain, it was called the Latter Rain message. You were leaving the churches to join the message, and you're becoming better than the others. So I guess the next question that would build up to, you've got the submission, you've got the control, you've got the leaving. Once you left, did they start to train you that you were the elite Christian, or you were some level above the other Christians?
Yes. Again, it's in the book. I just read it before we got on. It's a really common phrase that we hear in YWAM, and it is, God doesn't call the qualified, he qualifies the called. And so there's a lot of grandiosity about if you're called into YWAM, like Lauren Cunningham said, YWAM is a calling. And if you leave YWAM, you lose your calling. So if you are called into YWAM, it doesn't matter how qualified you are. It doesn't matter your expertise. What matters is who you know. And it's very much a system built on personality and relationships. And so that makes you feel very special, you know, like, okay, I have been called. You'll see a really common pattern where someone will do a DTS. And I would say the vast majority of people who do a DTS are then sort of pulled aside by a leader or a staff person in their DTS and said, like, hey, we've been praying and we feel like God is calling you to come back and staff with us. And that feels very special, you know, especially if you have been trauma bonded with these people, you have given up so much, you have really done a lot of mental gymnastics to try to come to the point where this is your community, this is your family, language is used a lot. And so there is this sense of, now I've got a little bit of the secret. Now I'm sort of in. And now I'm being asked to come back and join staff. And then maybe once you join staff, I'm being asked to staff a school, or I'm being asked to go start a base in another country. So certainly there, that continues to perpetuate the idea of, we have a secret knowledge. We are better than other missions organizations because we are not caring so much about our bodies. Because we are going where no one else will go. We'll break all of the rules. We'll break all of the laws of a country, to get in, you know, we'll follow the heroes of the faith. So certainly there is an idea of feeling special and being told that you are special because you're called, and that people outside don't understand.
I'm thinking even just the name Youth with a Mission. It's so much it's a military operation for God, and it is this sense of, you are the elite, you're the Navy SEALs of the missions organizations, so you have these like special ops that you're supposed to go to. And a lot of the language is military language, like, we're going to go to target nations and these are our target nations. And it's so much of a sense of grandiosity, I think, is a great word. And as a mental health counselor, obviously, I'm not going to diagnose people that are not my clients. And what I will say is that part of the structure of YWAM is a narcissistic structure. And it tends to suck in, including myself, those of us who want to feel really good, those of us who want to feel really grandiose, those of us who maybe need a little more robust puffing up of ourselves. And if we haven't done a lot of work to try to navigate that, I think that it then favors those types of people who end up in more positions of power. And so I think it's really important to look at kind of the specialized Christian messaging with an ideology of grandiosity.
Yeah, because it's so connected relationally, that it is becomes about who you know, if you want to move up in the organization, right? It's really about who you know, what sort of backroom conversations you're in. I was told when I was part of the member care team for Member Care Europe, that, you know, we were going to these conferences, these YWAM conferences, and you're in a conference all day. I'm tired. I'm an introvert. I want to go to bed. And my teammates were telling me, oh no, we got to go out and drink with the leaders because it's this sort of like after party. And this is where you get known, Shelby. So if you want to be influential in member care, this is where you get known, because all of these leaders hang out and they drink together and they like hang out until 2 a.m. or something. And so it had nothing to do with my qualifications or my experience or the things I'd worked in for years. It was only about, was I willing to, you know, beat my body down to stay up super late night after night, go out, you know, and drink with these people in order to be known. And this was actually when my member care team sort of threw me under the bus at the end of my connection with YWAM there. They sort of sacrificed me because they were told to either get rid of me, like blacklist me, or they would lose all their influence. So it had nothing to do with their qualifications, their ability to reach people, to do good member care work. It was, you know, we're going to strip away your influence. We're going to not send people to you if you don't blacklist, you know, this person. So it's very much that interconnected, like you said, that sort of grandiose and narcissistic sort of tendency to want to feel like we have the power over others.
So I guess the last question that I would raise before we get really deep into it, with the language that was being spread through the Latter Rain movement, where you're telling people we need to come out, we need to be separate, we need to leave family, loved ones behind. With that language came another aspect of this, which was a language that was saying something to the effect, you have to put off the old man and bring on the new. We had different ways of phrasing it, but essentially it was this. It wasn't just a rebirth. It was an alteration of your personality. You won't be the same person once you come into this. And when you combine those two things together, what you have really is an indoctrination into a more deeper control. It edges into mind control, if you understand how mind control works. For me, that was all of the elements that were necessary to create a destructive cult. And it did. It created hundreds of little cults that spun off of this thing. Did they have that type of language?
Yes, there was absolutely the language of, you know, dying to the old self, dying to your flesh, dying to your desires, in order to be made new. This principle of you've got to give everything up, including who you are. So your agency, your identity, your instincts, your mind, you know, little by little, it gets chipped away. And that was all with the idea of becoming more mature, becoming more Christ-like, becoming a better YWAMer. One thing that was used a lot was the YWAM DNA. So people were told, if, you know, you're like, hey, I want to be a part of the leadership team, or I want to lead something, and it was sort of believed that you weren't like good enough for that yet, they would say maybe like, well, you just don't have the YWAM DNA yet. You've only been here for 3 years. Like, you don't really have it deeply. And so then you were constantly trying to remake yourself into the vision of what you were being told you should be looking like, the language you should be using, who could die to themselves the most, who could suffer the most, you know, sort of thing, or who was getting the more invitations to go speak at other places or whatever. So yes, there was certainly this attitude of, there's the spiritual side of it, of die to yourself, become, you know, more Christ-like. And then there was the really specific missional side of it, of become a better YWAMer.
Yeah, I was also thinking about the YWAM DNA and how prevalent that is. And I think it also, and this maybe will dovetail into us getting into the foundations, is that it was also spun into a theology where it was like, if you look in the mirror, you should see nothing but Jesus. And the YWAM DNA was the same thing as God or as Jesus or as this very, very specific image of what God was. And so it was sort of this theology and this spirituality of, I need to keep emptying myself and become more like Jesus, who just so happened to look a lot like Lauren Cunningham and the other leaders in YWAM.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So that combination, when you mix all of those different things together, it is the recipe that's necessary for mind control. Especially, I mean, to put off the old person, put on the new, that language itself, you can read books of what this does to your psyche. You're basically telling yourself that you must deny yourself. I was in one of the, it was a mainstream church I was in, and they were trying to tell me that it was a sin to be angry, which I think I've talked, it might have been with you, Jenny, that we talked about this. And that's something that just literally puts a leash around your neck, because every person is going to have an emotion that's built into your human makeup, your DNA. You're going to have it. And a healthy person, instead of being trained to deny that they have this, they're trained instead to be able to control this. In your anger, do not sin, is what Paul said. So anytime that you tell people that you're going to change your personality, you're going to alter your personality, you're going to alter your psychological makeup, leave your friends and family behind, join us, become the spiritual elite, and submit, these elements are what hijack the brain. And that's for somebody who is under the age of 30, I'm looking at the ranges of people inside of Youth with a Mission, this is the group of people who are most susceptible to this kind of indoctrination. So for me, this is a little bit scary what you're telling me.
Yeah, it is certainly something that becomes very formulaic. So they talk a lot about following principles, you know, principles that are found, quote unquote, found in the Bible. And you see this even in Making Jesus Lord. You see it in, of course, the other books that Lauren Cunningham has written and the books that you're often required to read if you're doing any sort of training within YWAM. And so it becomes a formula, you know, so that's, you see like prosperity gospel teaching, you know, that if you give up your money, if you give up your stuff, then you will receive something back. And it's simply to, it's most common to quote it as, this is a principle. This is a life principle. It's a biblical principle. You do A plus B, you get C. And so that feels very powerful. If you think, well, I can get the secret formula, I'm being taught and told the secret formula. And then like Jenny said, you know, if you're like, I'm praying for this money or something like that, and, you know, some anonymous donation comes in and you're like, it was the Lord, the formula worked. When really it was, you know, Aunt Susie or, you know, Grandpa behind just super concerned about you and your well-being and wanting to make sure that you are getting what you need. The fact that they present various formulas as the way to get what you need or want, to become closer to God, quote unquote, to, you know, achieve some sort of higher transcendence, spiritually or practically, that feels really, enticing, because of course we want to feel in control. And here's someone telling you, well, if you do this, if you lay down all of your rights, then God's going to, you know, if you lay down your rights to marriage, God's going to give you a spouse. If you lay down your right to, you know, safe housing, like, well, I don't know anybody that actually has safe housing in a lot of parts of the world. it becomes formulaic, which is very, enticing for people, I think, especially like you said, young people whose frontal cortex is not fully formed. They're out there in the world. They're unsure of what they should be doing, where they should be going. And then here is a sort of ready-made group of people saying, hey, we are very happy to tell you what to do and where to go.
Yeah. So I think maybe even just getting into that a little bit more and even what those principles look like could be illuminating for folks. And so one of the principles, or a cluster of the principles, is known as YWAM's foundational values. And if it's okay, I'll just read number one. You can find these online, they're public knowledge. But the one is says to know God, which is like, great, Awesome. Who wouldn't want to know God? But we'll get into a little bit more of how this actually plays out. And it says, YWAM is committed to know God, his nature, his character, and his ways as revealed in the Bible and inspired and authoritative word of God. We seek to reflect who he is in every aspect of our lives and ministry. Automatic overflow of knowing and enjoying fellowship with God is desired to share him with others. And so I read this as a woman, and I see in a very short paragraph, there are five he's and hims that describe God. And so I go, okay, what does that look like for me to know God in my own self and in my own identity and body? And one of the things that I have seen consistently across various nations and countries is the pretty misogynistic, sexist structure of YWAM, that it is more kind of what you would call complementarian, which is like men are created to lead and women are called to their husbands. And it becomes this power imbalance. And so the discrepancy between who gets to keep their rights and who has to give them up is even in the very first value, and we can talk more about that. But that is one of the things that sticks out to me the most, is the strong gendered language of a God that, again, looks very similar to Lauren Cunningham. And your proximity to looking like Lauren Cunningham is probably going to influence the power and privilege you have in that institution.
We've talked before about Dr. Stephen Hassan's book, Combating Cult Mind Control. He goes deep into what it means to be programmed, and so that people who are submitting themselves to this kind of thing can recognize that something has happened to their brain that's outside of their control. I'm curious what it looks like on the other side. See, we've talked about the recipe for what could potentially control minds within Youth with a Mission, but now let's talk about the other side. It goes more than textbook, because you even see this in the movies. You'll find these groups of people in movies who are joining cults in movies, and they're saying things about how bad they were before, what life was like before joining, how awful it was, we were doing the wrong thing, saying we believe the wrong things. There's just it takes putting off the old man to a new level, because what's happening essentially is their identity is changing and morphing to become the group's identity. And anything that does not match the group's identity, they see as wrong, whether it's wrong or not. What did it look like once you joined from the youth side? Did they have this type of aspect happening to them?
Yes, you're always told once a YWAMer, always a YWAMer. I find that hard now that I've left. There is an incredible sense of belonging when you join. It's often, you know, very warm, very, there's a lot of excitement, you know, people are there to get closer to God. And I think especially for a young adult who's sort of getting out into the world for the first time, maybe, that can feel really scary. To like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with my life, or maybe I'm taking a gap year and I'm going to do this, you know, DTS sort of thing. And so to, I think, be offered such a complete space where they will take care of your spirituality, they will take care of your relationships, they will take care of your finances, they'll tell you what to do with your money, essentially. All of these things, you know, if you're having mental health challenges, they'll help you pray it away, quote unquote. It's a package deal in so many ways for so many people. And certainly people come do a DTS and they're like, that's fine. That's great. That's enough. Thank you. Bye. But unfortunately we see, you know, tens of thousands of people who get into that very full identity. And that becomes their identity, where you don't have time or maybe energy to engage outside of the organization, to go to local church or to make local friends or to learn a language of the country that you're living in. So does that answer your question about that, John?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about what it would be like if this were reframed to know yourself, and how if it was an institution that honored and privileged true like diversity and people living and looking and loving differently, that to me is healthy. It's when it becomes this monoculture, and it feels good so long as you begin to assimilate. And you know, I think in almost every school I was in, there was probably at least one person that was also sent there to like straighten them out. And maybe by the end they were straightened out because they're like, wow, this is actually really great. And then what happens when that person goes home? You know, it's like it things can be good until you start to ruffle feathers, until you start to ask questions, and still until you start to say, hey, how come the only gender we have for God is he? Then things really quickly shift and you get labeled a Jezebel, or you get labeled divisive, or like these very strong retributions that come if you just step out a little bit of what the culture says you're supposed to be.
I want to go back to something that you were discussing earlier about whenever the youth goes on the mission, suddenly the contact with the parents is severed. There was a group here that was labeled a destructive cult by some of its members. I won't give the name, but they were doing the same thing. The children would go to this youth retreat or this youth camp, and whenever they did, they had to forfeit their cell phones, no email, no text, no outside communications, and the parents were not allowed to contact them through the entire, I don't know what it was, week, 2 weeks, whatever. And suddenly, there was an issue, and one of the parents raised a ruckus because they can't get access to the child, which is problematic. If you're a parent, you realize how bad this is. Now, granted, this was much younger people than you're dealing with, of course, but the issue remains the same. If it's something that is transparent, you wouldn't care if the parents are contacting. Hey, we're training your youth to become better. They're becoming better. See, watch along. Watch as the progress happens, right? In fact, I was talking to, I can't remember which denomination it was, but they had sent their children on some sort of a youth retreat camp, and nightly pictures were posted so they could see what's happening. They had full access to the child at any time. They could call, get to the camp authorities. It was just so transparent. I'm curious what it's like from the parent side as well.
Well, to my experience and the experience of the people and the clients that I've worked with, the parents weren't given a choice. Like the parents weren't contacted by YWAM to inform them of anything. There is, I think, on YWAM.org, potentially, there's a sort of like notes for parents, or maybe that was on a specific base I was looking up. So some bases will have that. Sort of like if you have frequently asked questions, but it's still, I've not seen where there's been like an active participation towards getting the parents to remain in contact with their young people. It's most often, hey, parents, this is a time set apart for God. You know, so like, trust us, we've got your kids, like, that's okay. Certainly, I remember by the time I was in Perth, Australia, I was 27. And they didn't forbid us to speak to our family at that point because I was in a second level school. But they made it extremely difficult to contact anybody outside of the country. And like, you couldn't go out. You could only use a payphone. They wouldn't provide any sort of like care or space for you to call. This was before like our, you know, Wi-Fi or smartphones and things like that. And you, as a woman, you couldn't go find a payphone on your own. You had to have someone else come with you because it, quote unquote, wasn't safe enough in the neighborhood that the base was in. So you had to sort of beg someone, hey, I've got to go find where I can buy like a phone card and like an international phone card. And then I have to beg someone to come with me to go find a payphone somewhere. And I have to time it so where I can actually speak with my family. And then they have to just sit there, and they couldn't sit more than like 2 meters away from you or something like that. Like there was also a rule about how far the person, as a woman, at least, I think for men, it was different, you know, that the person couldn't be, it was more than 6 feet. They couldn't be more than 6 feet away from you. And this was part of the accountability, keeping accountability so that like you didn't say things to your family that would shine poorly on the base there. And I remember like sort of speaking into the phone to my older sister, and I was like, I think I might be part of a cult. She was like, I think you might, like, do we need to come get you, you know, in Australia? And I was like, no, it's okay. Like, I've put so much money and time into this. Like, I can tough it out. I can make it, you know, I'm so close to getting this quote unquote degree done. It was wild actually to experience that, where I wasn't even allowed to have a private conversation. Someone had to, and I was, you know, 27 at that point. So not, you know, not a youngin like so many of the people that were there. So from my experience and the people that I've worked with over the years, the parents are not actively involved.
Yeah, my experience was similar. It was also pre iPhone, smartphone, and it sort of wasn't like talked about, don't talk to your family, but there's no privacy. You know, I always had at least one roommate, usually three, shared bathrooms, shared common spaces, probably a remote base that's really hard to get anywhere else, and similar rules, don't go out without other people. And so when I was on outreach, my very first DTS, well, only DTS, but my first like entry level school, my outreach, a month of it was in the red light district in Thailand. And we were 18, 19, 20 year olds going into bars, which was incredibly unsafe and traumatizing for all of us for different reasons. And we maybe would have one day a week we could go to an internet cafe on our own time and send an email. But none of us had phones or really ways to message. And so it was sort of, I don't know how much it was by design or purpose, but there definitely was a lack of communication, but also similar to that rhetoric of people aren't going to understand you, you're ruined for the ordinary. There was a not so subtle messaging, like your family probably has a spirit of fear, so they're going to worry about you and not understand, you know? And like, I have my brother email me and be like, those bars are run by like cartels. What are you doing? You know? And I'm like, I'm fine. Jesus is with us. And again, this grandiosity that everything's going to be okay. And I have many, 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 many stories from people across the world where things were not okay. And very horrific things have happened to people that don't get talked about or shared.
I think I read where there are a few last words of the snake handlers who were saying everything's going to be okay, but it's so problematic when you think of how all of this has developed. Interestingly, some of the groups that we have talked about on the podcast have started to reform, whether it's based off of things that we've said or not. There are people who are trying to make positive change. I guess the next question that I would ask you, well, two-part question. Number one, do you think YWAM could change? But number two, if they were to change for the better, how would you recommend that they change to become better?
I've been out of it for about 18 months. And so I'm not too far gone from it. I still have people that I love and care about deeply who are in it. I'm still connected in some ways around the world. Also part of a group on Facebook, a spiritual abuse and YWAM Facebook group that has close to 1,300 members now. And I would say that unfortunately, you see more scandals breaking. And that's somehow thanks to the internet, social media, and people, I think even a younger generation who is more aware of their own agency and willing to speak up and share experiences and things like that. There's a big split going on right now at the YWAM Kona base with Fire and Fragrance. Don't ask me, just look it up. And then this, I think it's a DTS maybe called Brave Love. I don't know this. So they're splitting. Andy Bird, who runs Fire and Fragrance, like essentially YWAM was like, y'all are to Cuckoo, we can't have you as part of us anymore. So that's happening in various places. I know YWAM Tyler, Texas, that happened recently. There was two or three instances in YWAM England, where sort of YWAM eventually had to come and say, hey, you guys can't use the name of YWAM anymore because it's just gone too far. Unfortunately, in all of those instances, it's been like a years long process, and it has been only at the point where the scandal has affected the local community. So I'm not talking about like the YWAM community. So victims have been speaking up for years about these cases, about these instances, trying to see justice done, trying to receive help, trying to get leaders out of those positions. And I'm talking like sexual abuse, like physical abuse, like crazy stuff, as well as very intense spiritual abuse. And unfortunately, up until this point, it does seem like it's only once the scandal touches the local populace in some way, whether it's a local church or something like that, that then YWAM sort of steps in and says, okay, like we've tried to talk to these leaders and to get them to repent and to try to reconcile and to try to hear from all sides, quote unquote, and all of this sort of stuff. And then it's sort of like the worst of the worst, like the legitimate like cult leader people that are finally, you know, being like, okay, these guys really won't listen to us as YWAM. And so we have to tell them they can no longer use the YWAM name, even though many of them still are. Like YWAM Tyler, Texas is still calling themselves YWAM. Like there is a thing on their website that says like, oh yeah, we sort of split amicably and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, that is not the situation. But what can YWAM do? And I think that that's something that me and Jenny have talked about, is the, like she was saying earlier about sort of the monoculture that is created, where there is supposed to be this decentralization and this like, you know, lots of different flavors and things like that. But ultimately there's one right way to follow, and there is no code of conduct. Like YWAM doesn't have any code of conduct ever. So they have the foundational values, which we'll continue to get in probably on later episodes. You know, they have their covenant words, their four legacy words, I think. And these are all from like Lauren Cunningham. But there is no code of conduct that you sign. And so therefore it's really hard to get rid of people. It takes a lot for YWAM leadership to finally come and say like, okay, you are too much. Like we actually have to remove you. And I think to answer the second part of your question, John, about, you know, what would it take to sort of see YWAM reform? And I have pondered this question for years, and I'd love to hear Jenny's take as well. But having been in it as long as I was, and having fought as hard as I did for abuse victims, including myself in my own situation here in Switzerland, but also sort of globally in the areas that I was working in and trying to advocate for abuse victims within the system of YWAM, we've just seen this systemic and often systematic refusal to take accountability, right? So accountability is certainly a piece. I have found, you know, at some point I thought if we could just get systems, if we could just get policies and procedures in place, if there could just be proper accountability structures, then that would be okay. And I really quickly realized that even if you have accountability structures in place, the culture of the organization, like Jenny was saying, the sort of monoculture exists. And until the culture is changed, I'm not sure we're going to see any real lasting like repentance and reparations made towards victims. But the culture is so deeply influenced by the theology. And that's why we want to, we're looking at the NAR connections to how deeply is this influencing this organization. Like you said, the Latter Rain, the Word of Faith movements, you know, all of these things that have sort of seeped in and flavored. And when I think about trying to explain to people the system of YWAM, I sort of try to think of it as like, there's this group of people at the top who are making a cake mix. So that's the founder's circle, you know, Darlene Cunningham, David Hamilton, I think, you know, all of these people that are sort of there are people at the top. And so they're sort of the ones that with the legacy words and the covenant words and all of these things, they're creating this cake mix, right? That they're like, okay, then we have these big conferences, the global leadership conferences, where it's all of the, you know, top leaders of the world come together and they're all given this cake mix. But maybe the flour is like rancid. And so they take this cake mix and they're all eating this cake mix and then they take it back to their little like kingdoms, you know, their little bases and places like this. And maybe someone adds in chocolate chips or maybe someone adds in some more butter. Like everybody adds their little flavor, but ultimately it's the same cake mix, right? And the cake mix is maybe off. It's expired or it's got something in it that is going to make you like maybe a little bit sick. And people start to eat this cake and you're like, oh, my tummy doesn't feel really great, but you just keep eating. Right. And then maybe eventually you sort of like get used to it. Like you sort of become immune to it and you're like, oh, this cake is pretty good. Like it's sustaining me. Like everyone else is eating the cake. Like it's fine. And maybe someone new comes in and they get violently ill from eating the cake. And you're like, well, what's wrong with you? And they're like, this cake mix is bad. Like it's gone off, you know, like the ingredients have soured. Like we need to change the cake mix. You know, we need to stop importing this cake mix. And that person is often run out, you know, because it's like, well, we're all fine. Like we've eaten the cake and yeah, maybe I have a rumbly tummy sometimes, but I'm okay. And then those people are sort of, you know, you just don't get it. You don't like our flavor of cake mix, you know, maybe go to somewhere else and maybe someone has sort of sifted the weevils out of their cake mix or they've replaced the flour or something. And so you might find a place where you feel like, oh, their cake is pretty good. Like it's, I don't feel sick when I eat it. And that person's maybe there for some months or some years, and then they leave because the top people don't like the fact that they've changed the cake mix and like taken out the weevils and things like that. So they maybe leave and then someone else comes in who will continue to feed the cake mix from the top. So I think until the cake mix is changed, until the recipe is changed, I'm genuinely not sure that we'll see reform. Because, you know, we've talked a lot about this before, about how it's about souls, not bodies.
Yeah, I don't think I have too much to add on that right now, other than the cake mix seems to be working for those who are making it. And so I am skeptical, you know, of course, I do think miracles can happen and maybe there could be a really giant reform. But because the institution is really built on Seven Mountains mandate and these things that are so missional, I don't have much of an imagination for how it could reform in a way that would care for the bodies within it, other than a massive, massive overhaul. And I haven't seen leaders be enticed by an overhaul yet. If you're out there, let us know.
One just last thing that I think is really interesting to Jenny's points is the belief by people who are in the organization that, well, we're fine in our location. You know, we're good people. So we're not like them. So I can hear your horror stories. I can care very deeply about the fact that you've been harmed. But like, I'm still going to stay in YWAM because my stuff is okay. So it's this interesting paradox between why I'm saying like, we're not a church, you know, we're a parachurch organization, we're a movement. In fact, they call themselves a movement. They're not an organization. They say that. And so we don't have to follow those rules. But then at the same time, it's like, well, that's not my job. You know, I'm not the one, like we're so decentralized that anybody can do anything. And so it's like, they're trying to carry these two things that we are a movement, we're all the same, but also like, I can deal with whatever's going on over there because we're decentralized.
Well, all of this is concerning, and you actually have answered my last question. Usually, when a group turns destructive, usually they start to create splinter groups. And you've answered that question, so I won't go there. Thank you so much for doing this. I was really curious to dive deeper, and I hope in the upcoming episodes we can go even further. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm really grateful we can have these conversations and look forward to getting into them deeper.
Awesome. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.